Happy Workers' Day. Today is May 1st, and all around the world, except in North America, it's Workers' Day. So it's the day that reminds that if you struggle for rights, you may end up being called a terrorist and even executed, which is what happened in Chicago and to 8 activists, unionist workers, migrants, anarchists also, that wanted workers' rights. Interesting is that the day or the commemoration of that 120 years ago when the union started to discuss commemorating and so on was always a subject of tremendous debate. It was highly polemical among the unions and so on. Eric Hobsbawm wrote an incredible story of May 1st showing all that struggle. And May 1st became Workers' Day because the workers, the plain old workers, thought that it was a very good idea to have a free day. So the unions, the parties, and so on wanted them to demonstrate, and later on, every political power and so on around the world, from all kinds of ideologies, from the Nazis to the Stalinists and so on, commemorated Workers' Day. But basically, the day persisted because the workers said, hey, let's stay at home, let's go out to the park and have a picnic with the family. That's the real history of people deciding something is a good idea. And that ends up happening. I think that's the very interesting lesson of the day. Workers' rights are at the beginning and at the essence of what we now know as social rights and limitation of the working day to 8 hours, conditions, retirement, and all those things came out of those struggles. At some moment that seemed to be successful. So much that those rights are enshrined in almost every constitution around the world. They are enshrined in the constitution of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank that says that full employment is what those organizations should be achieving. And the same for the World Trade Organization. Problem is that those things are in the preamble. But then end up difficult being implemented, or the gains that we thought were there forever because the previous generations had conquered them can be lost. And that is one of the lessons of what happened in the last 20 years between 1989, fall of the Berlin Wall, that same author Hobsbawm said, this is the end of the 20th century, a very short century that started in 1914 with the First World War and ended in 1989 with the fall of the Berlin Wall. Lately, same Hobsbawm said, well, it was a bit hurried to call the end of the 20th century 1989. It actually ended in September 2008 with the fall of the other wall, the fall of Wall Street. So the two systems of the 20th century collapsed with the falling walls. The Stalinist system collapsed in Berlin, and the neoliberal system created collapsed in Wall Street. At least ideologically. At least in terms of who will defend them. And you know, when the main operators of the politics that led to the financial crisis went to bring their testimony to Congress and said, we didn't see it happen. We never thought that this would come out. Nobody predicted it. They are acknowledging to the intellectual collapse of the doctrines, some would say the theology, you know, because it's the belief in an invisible hand that, as Nobel Peace Prize Joseph Stiglitz said, it's invisible, nobody has seen it because it doesn't exist. The markets do not regulate themselves. And if you leave it to their own, what they create is collapse. What they have created in the last 20 years is this phenomenon of the working poor. It used to be that the unemployed and the left out and so on were the poor. Now we have the working poor on top of the unemployment, on top of what is a dramatic increase in inequality. I think during the whole day we heard really amazing interventions and about rights, and I was really excited to be here and to see what is in the forefront of the thinking about rights. Let's take the other part. Let's talk a bit about equal, which is, in a sense, what we lost in the way. You know, some people would say, yes, equal rights means we all have the same equal rights to buy a Porsche, and we all have the same equal obligation not to sleep under the bridge. And that applies to everybody, rich or poor. Yeah. That is old saying, and that is old wisdom. The world is unequal. And if you treat their equals equally, you only reinforce inequality. And that is why, already at the end of the 19th century, social policies were created. And that is why the state started to have a role in redistribution and participation in society, creating social security, protecting the children, and so on. In 1995, after the collapse of the communist system, the end of the Cold War, the notion that there would be a peace dividend coming out of the end of the Cold War, governments of the world committed themselves to two things. Gender equality, which was promised in Beijing, and we remember today, was already in their Indiana recognition that women's rights are human rights, and eradication of poverty. And the text of the UN resolution that commits that says, since poverty can be eradicated, and we have the means, the technology, the knowledge, the capacity to eradicate poverty from the world, if we don't do that, then the whole system is really challenged. How can we claim for a global system that being able to do that task is not doing it? It will not only be ethically not admissible, but also politically generating an unviable situation. At the same time, rights were being created for corporations. And while the UN was in charge of the social agenda, and the social agenda was redefined with the Convention of the Rights of the Children, with the recognition of women rights as human rights, with the all the different UN conferences building that agenda and building the ethical and moral and even legal standard for that, without the peace to enforce it, the regulations were being put in place that gave the corporations the right to move around the world, to establish whenever they want, to move out of the world whenever they want, to litigate against governments with their own system of justice, not under the courts that normal citizens use. No, Philip Morris in this day is very mad because in my country, Uruguay, the government is forcing them to put health warnings in their tobacco boxes. And they have found out that people still identify the different colors, Marlboro red, Marlboro blue, as the blue meaning light, and therefore less dangerous for health, which is really a lie, or which is tricking people into still smoking or channeling their fears of cancer into smoking light cigarettes. So they said, no, you cannot do that anymore. You have Marlboro, that's Marlboro, that's it. No colors on the box. The company not only retaliated, but in the name of intellectual property rights, it is suing the Uruguayan government in Washington. You know, the cost of hiring the lawyers to defend the right of the country to protect its health will be more than what Philip Morris is claiming as an indemnization. And the whole thing is that they want to make a point that then they can take all over the world. Those rights are enforced and put in place with human rights terminology. We had a very interesting debate a few weeks ago in Geneva, convened by Mary Robinson, with economists and human rights people, and Pascal Lamy, the head of the World Trade Organization, went there and said, we have a common language. All what the WTO is about non-discrimination, which is the same issue that we are dealing here. Non-discrimination means that your government cannot favor a women's cooperative when buying, say, police uniforms that can be produced locally by women or small producers and so on, and instead cannot discriminate foreign company that comes in offering the same product imported from whatever. Non-discrimination means in practice that you cannot precisely compensate for the people that are not equal. And that is the vulnerable, and that is the local population. And this is how, in the imbalance of rights that was politically created in the last 20 years, there is nothing of a natural phenomenon around growing poverty in the world, as there is nothing of a natural phenomenon around the collapse in Wall Street and around the whole economy of the world being brought down by the banks. Those were political decisions that were taken at a moment to allow these people to do that, or not to control them, or to let it go in spite of the many, many warnings that were really there and that were ignored. My own country, Uruguay, suffered a financial crisis of proportionally a similar magnitude in 2001, together with Argentina. Financial crisis had happened in Russia before, had happened in Southeast Asia. And everywhere, the result was the same. The banks collapsing, the state has to rescue them because they are too big to fail. Taxpayers' money is going to rescue the bankers. The difference is, for example, in the case of Philippi, all the major bank owners ended in jail. Their banks were rescued because the economy needed to continue, IMF was called in to help, and so on. But the courts found out, hey, what these people were doing was illegal. It was basically a Ponzi scheme, or they were lending money to themselves, treating the different clients differently, taking from one country, client to give to the other, which was themselves. So we put them in jail. Okay, the banks were rescued, the IMF came in, structural adjustment came in. One of the things that the country had to do to be able to receive that money was to repeal the law that allowed to put those people in jail. Which is exactly what has happened, or what had happened already on Wall Street. Hopefully there is some debate still about whether somebody will end up in jail or not, but that will not really repair for any of the damage created. In an unequal world, the basic rights are still the rights of the people to take decisions, to select the governments, to define the policies. In the real world, what happens is that the ability of those governments to decide on the policies has been severely limited. The budget, which is so important, of some 70 countries that are independent, is decided between the finance ministers and the donors, coordinated by the World Bank. When that budget goes to Parliament, Parliament has no option. The fight between the President and the Parliament in Honduras started when President Zelaya sent a budget to the Parliament, in which he had no a majority, and told the parliamentarians, hey, you know, please be patriotic and do not look into that budget. Hey, come on, we have a constitution here. Yes, we have a constitution, but you know, the G16 is the World Bank and the 15 bilateral donors of Honduras, the G16, you know, we negotiated this package, and it took us, it's a long time to negotiate and so on, so you cannot change it, or we would have to renegotiate it all again, and then we don't have money to pay the public employees. Parliament approved it and said, yeah, but never more. The next year, same thing happened. You know, the parliamentarians started to get mad. The third year, when the situation was already in a crisis, Hugo Chavez came in and said, what's all this fuss about? Yeah, you know, $150 million extended that check. That's the real root of what was going on. Now, if you are destroying the very basis of democracy around the world in the name of helping the poor, you end up distorting and really making it completely unable to do the real policies. What are the real policies? The real policies is what every country that has successfully developed and overcome poverty did, which is protect its industry, redistribute, educate, and care for the health of the people. And it's just observation that in different stages all along the 19th century and the 20th century the countries that have succeeded have done. What are the countries being told to do? Go and do charity with the extremely poor, so that you lift them up a little bit over the poverty line and they disappear from the map of the statistics, because they went up from 98 cents, which was below $1 a day, to 102. Now it's 1.25, okay, 1.27. Problem solved. You know, poverty has been raised. Even so, we are not meeting the Millennium Development Goals that people, many people are calling the Minimum Development Goals. And it is very clear, very, very clear that we are not meeting them, because in absolute and relative numbers, and that is in the latest report of the U.S. Secretary General, if you take China out, poverty has increased in all the Western world. And reduction of poverty in China has many reasons, and some of it is also an accounting mechanism and not real reduction, but even so, what they didn't do was precisely to follow all the results, but to follow somehow their own way. Equality. Equal dignity for everybody, dignity for all. We assume that at least all the government and people and so on pay some attention to that and believe in that. Yet, in Copenhagen last December, the proposal submitted by the richest countries of the world basically implied we reserve for our citizens the right to consume 10 times more energy than what you will ever consume. Because you know there is a limit, and you cannot consume more because the atmosphere and so on will not allow it. So you have to accept that you will be always poor and unable to care for your very basic needs of energy so that we can keep our own consumption. Now there is a worldwide protest against that. And there is a worldwide sense of wanting to dissociate with those mechanisms and let's do things differently. In Cochabamba last week, there was a People's Summit on Climate. And during that summit, it was announced that the U.S. government was cutting $2.5 million of aid from Ecuador because they didn't want to join that accord signed in Copenhagen. President Correa said, I have $2.5 million here that I'm willing to give to President Obama if he signs the Kyoto Protocol. And that news went all around the world. Because in an equal world, that makes no sense. And he has all the same right to propose a bribe of $2 million to change your country policy, or another bribe to do the same thing. Yesterday, Senator Pearson was reminding us that the sense of fairness and the energy to struggle when something is not fair is something that we also have in children from as soon as they have a notion of society or others. And it is that sense of fairness what is mobilizing people, and on that sense of fairness we have to base a program based on justice. Financial justice that makes the banks pay for the damage they created. And there are the technical formulas to do that. Some of them will be discussed in Toronto this June by the G20. Gender justice, social justice, and climate justice. And finally, plain old justice, meaning courts and tribunals, so you can really put the people violating those rights into jail. Thank you very much.